Radio City. It is John Grace and Rob Ross hanging out with you and doing a little bit of talking for the next hour or so. And as we do each week, we check in on what's going on in the nation's Big Apple. Where sits Rob Ross right now? What's happening in New York?
Well, unfortunately, the Yankees are in the playoffs, but thankfully right now Boston has a 1-0 lead in the early in the game. The series is tied up, and hopefully the Yankees will not win, because it's bad enough that the Dodgers just won, having taken out the Braves 3-1. Earlier today, the Astros finished their sweep of the Indians in very, very fashionable style. I think it was 11-2 was the final score there. And yesterday, the Rockies got a beating at the hands of the Brewers. I think it was 6-0 when all was said and done. So this turned out to be not an exciting or lengthy round of playoffs. Although I have to admit, having grown up in that era where you had just the National League playoffs and then the World Series, you know, having it drag out to almost November, I'm glad that it's going quickly.
Right, right. And as you know, I mean, the Cardinals are out of it, so everybody in St. Louis has completely lost interest in baseball and moved right onto the NHL, where the St. Louis Blues opened the regular season 0-2, and now everybody's ready to slash their wrist there as well.
Well, that's fine, because the Rangers are 0-3, as you well know.
Right.
You know, they looked lousy against the Predators. Lundqvist was asleep at the wheel.
Yep.
They looked ghastly against the Sabres, and yesterday they had the lead and they gave it up five times, because they were leading 2-0, 3-2, 4-3, 5-4. And then they just gave it up and lost 8-5.
Right.
So,
well, and the Rangers have the same problem the Blues do right now, which is zero goaltending, or at least zero reliable goaltending at all. And, you know, you've got to build a team like that. You got to build a team from between the pipes out, and anything else just doesn't work. So if the goaltending falls apart, I don't care how good your defense is. If the goaltending cannot be counted on, you're done.
Well, here's the thing. You know, they've paid how many millions for Henrik Lundqvist to not produce?
Right.
And I don't have any more to say than that, because the guy is completely unreliable. You know, he watched shots go by him against the Sabres. You saw it.
Yep.
I saw it. You know, it's just inexcusable. Now, yesterday they had that kid Georgiev in net. He's not the goaltender of the future, but I would rather stick with him for a while, because Lundqvist just cannot play. And I've had my fill of everybody making excuses. It is time to jettison him and that contract, trade him while he's, quote, a marketable commodity, and I say that very loosely, because I don't think he is by any stretch of the imagination. You get rid of him and get rid of Mark Stahl, and you just – everybody knew going into the season we're going to have to ride this one out, come hell or high water. It's just that if you can get something in return, do it.
Right.
And do it now.
And
don't do it later on.
Right. And it can't just be something in return. It's got to be somebody, again, that's going to be a fairly solid player for a decent amount of time, which is, I mean, I guess that's the trick to being a GM, right?
Well, the thing is, if you're going to do a rebuild, go completely young. Do a full rebuild.
Yep.
Don't keep a 37-year-old goaltender, you know, with a multi-million-dollar, multi-year, no-trade-clause contract in net, because that's insane.
Right. And, you know, we might as well stay on sports at least for a little while, because I'm celebrating a Victory Monday for the second time this year, and it was a pretty decent one as well. The Bills won at home this week and took down...
Oh, please.
I forgot you're another AFC East guy.
The Jets won very, very convincingly, might I add, against the Broncos. And by the way, the Giants lost again.
Right.
So that's even better.
Right. So you have the Yankees getting beaten. And yeah, the whole thing is going well for you in New York. But I got to crow about my Bills a little bit here, because they still have the same problems that any team does who's starting a rookie quarterback. Even though he's shown flashes of brilliance, he's shown many more flashes of being a rookie. So that's fine. But the defense was very, very suspect in week one and week two. And they have come back and taken over a couple of games. I mean, the two games that they've won, it was the defense that led the effort, forcing fumbles like crazy. So if they can keep that up, then who knows? There may be hope for this team yet.
Well, all I can say is it was nice to actually see the Jets not even at any point that I can remember when I came into watching the game yesterday, seeing them tied with the Broncos. They led and they kept that lead and kept building on it. I think the final score was what, 34-10?
Yeah.
So that's pretty nice, and, as far as I'm concerned.
And elsewhere in the AFC East, Miami piles up a 17-0 lead over the Bengals and then just figures, okay, so I guess we can coast through the rest of this one. Now, listen, I like watching the Dolphins lose as much as anybody, but 17-0 and you lose 27-17? That's bringing a new meaning to pathetic.
Good. That feels good. Whenever yeah, Miami loses, I'm sorry, I enjoy seeing them lose. But at the same time, you know, even though I did not go there to college, the one football team that I follow pretty well in the NCAA is, of course, the Georgia Bulldogs.
Oh, yeah.
And once again, they are just running roughshod over their opponents. You know, another, what was it, like 41-13 win. I mean, they're so unbelievably good, and yet they couldn't win the championship game. That still sticks in my craw, you know?
Right.
But I have a feeling they're going to have another perfect season. I hope they do. They deserve it. They're a great team, you know? So let's start with, the saddest of the news that we can muster. That is the passing, the very sudden passing of Jeff Emmerich.
Oh, yeah.
The legendary engineer from EMI Records who masterfully worked with George Martin and worked, of course, with the Beatles and the Hollies and everybody who came through those doors back in the 60s, and also happened to mix I Am the Cosmos for Chris Bell of Big Star. An unbelievable career. Like I said, legendary, probably doesn't even do him justice. It was a sudden massive heart attack, and just like that, he's gone. So yet another star goes out in the heavens.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, the Beatles catalog alone would have solidified his legacy forever as somebody who just, you know, was there. And that's, to me, that's the most exciting part of these guys. And the fact that it leads me to, I would love to, you know, learn more about them all. We've all seen documentaries on the Beatles. We've all seen documentaries on George Martin and that relationship and Brian Epstein. But the guys who were really putting the music together, they were doing that at a time when music recording itself was only, what, 30 years old?
Correct. And at the time, you know, especially in England, you know, they seriously went around in lab coats. You know, that was kind of the order of the day. You know, there were very stringent rules in recording, like you couldn't record a drum up close. You know, there had to be like a 6-foot gap. And, you know, other things. And Jeff Emmerich was truly, he was a visionary. I mean, he's the one who created ADT, you know, artificial double tracking. He was the one who came up with the idea of putting the mic right up against Ringo's drum, his bass drum, to get a full sound. He's the one who came up with the Leslie speakers, you know, that spin to get that foghorn effect on Lennon's voice on Tomorrow Never Knows. These are just some of the little nuances that were all by way of Jeff Emmerich.
Yeah.
And no one else. So, you know, he really and it was he who had come up with the idea of cutting the strips of sound and throwing them in the air and gluing them together at random to create that calliope sound on Mr. Kite, et cetera, et cetera. He's the one who worked in perfect harmony with George Martin to make the sounds in the Beatles collective heads become an audible reality.
Right. Yeah, and think about that job, being that kind of translator. And that's, to me, that is the ultimate experience for a studio producer, is somebody who can come up with those ideas that are going to make that translation easy.
And by the way, we have a special guest in our little recording studio on this end, my 15-year-old cat Paisley, who still looks and acts like a kitten. She doesn't want to move, so she may join in on and pipe in her opinions here and there as we go along.
You
so.
Know, the occasional meow is fine. I think that's perfect. It's a nice punctuation to us.
Hey, she's very conversational and very nice.
You know what's so, weird about know. That, though, is cats rarely meow at each other.
That's true. You know, we've got three, and Bailey, even though Bailey has settled right in and feels so at home and so happy and so loved and outwardly loving, which is wonderful that she's got that kind of personality showing through immediately, she is so chill with the other two, with Paisley and with Roxy. Paisley and Bailey don't get into it. They kind of look at each other politely. And Bailey might give a little squeak here and there in a very cute and very sweet and friendly way. Roxy, who's like half the size of Bailey, because Roxy's a perma kitten. I kid you not. So she's like a mini cat. She tries to be a little toughy, and she'll hiss, but it's just a comedic, cartoony hiss because she's the most underwhelming cat on the planet.
Ours just our one. You know, we have two, and one of them just can't be bothered with anybody or anything, and the other one is a constant asshole. He's great. I mean, I love him. He's wonderful, but he is a constant asshole. He's always looking for a way to screw with somebody. And what he'll do sometimes is he'll lay on the very corner of the top of the back of the couch and wait until the dogs walk by, because they're eventually going to have to walk by so that they can go outside. And as soon as they walk by, he'll start batting at their tails just to screw with them. You know, again, nothing malicious. He's just being an asshole.
That's what Roxy does with Bailey. You know, like as Bailey will walk by, and Bailey is very calm, and she doesn't turn and or do anything when Roxy does that. And yet Roxy will still hiss as Bailey's gone by. And if Paisley's going by, then she'll start with Paisley. But Paisley don't take no shorts from Roxy.
Right.
Because don't forget, Paisley's the alpha cat. You know, she kept Roxy in line for a long time once Roxy moved in. You know, so Roxy – I think Roxy's having the middle child syndrome. So, you know, it's a case of she'll chill out sooner than later. The fact is that Paisley is just so calm and yet really funnily bubbly. At 15, nothing has slowed her down. She's much more, you know, vivacious and fun and almost like a kitten all over again. And it's really cute and a lot of fun. And it's the one thing that I got to say, when I come home from a day at work, it immediately brings me right back down to being relaxed because it's just so joyful.
Yeah, cats are great. And you know, if you can be in a situation like ours where we've got both and just watch them interact, all the more zen comes out of that. It's a beautiful thing. Now, there's a ton going on in the world, and we'll get to some of the politics lead in just a little while, and I know everybody knows what's going on there. But before we do, there's something else that you and I have been covering for the last few shows in a row that deals with consumerism and the fact that we're seeing more of the names that we grew up with go by the wayside. Now, we did get some good news this week that it looks like somebody is going to buy the Toys R Us brand. So it may very well be a going concern again in the not too distant future, but it's going to look very different than it did when Toys R Us shut down.
Now, interestingly enough, it's not just in the United States because in England, they announced that Marks and Spencer is closing at least 100 of their physical stores, which is, it may have a domino effect or blow back to the United States, because over here, Brooks Brothers handles Marks and Spencer. And Brooks Brothers is, I wouldn't say high end, but medium end, medium to lower upper end.
Right.
If there's even such a thing. But,
you sounded like Groucho just yet, then. Still, he was on the lower upper end.
Well, Fenneman, the word of the day is DeSoto.
You left out a Hunger Dog. You left out the most important one, too.
Dry clothing into a wet martini. Anyway, so, you know, all right, buy a duck. Over in England, it's happening there, too, because you know, there are established name brands that just can't compete in the modern market either. And that, I think that's unfortunately their biggest scourge at the moment, because like everybody else, everyone's just ordering from whatever sources they can find. But also, there's a company that I'm sure most people are familiar with, Mattress Firm, who bought out the Sleepy's chain a couple of years ago. And Mattress Firm filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, and they're going to close their, quote, underperforming stores. Now, here's the problem, and it's very common sense. It's just very simply, this is one of those scenarios where you bought out your only real competition. Now there's no competition, and oversaturation of the market. What do you expect to happen?
Right. Yeah, you're going to see – boy, the weirdest thing is going on visually right now. Anyway, yeah, right. You're naturally going to see some attrition go on there. But yeah, I mean, when it goes back to Marks and Spencer, I think what it all comes down to is that Mott the Hoople was right. They told us about this, and that Wendy was stealing too many clothes from them.
Okay, you really didn't have to go into Ian Hunter's territory. Take the shades with the gaffer tape off and Shut up.
No, but I mean, it is, it's interesting to see, you know, and I want to know what goes into this Toys R Us reboot. And if it is indeed successful, if the paperwork gets signed and done and everything, buying a company out of receivership like that and bringing it back to life, they've tried it a number of times with varying degrees of success. I mean, Woolworths came back, what, 3 times before they finally gave up the ghost? So maybe, but it just depends on what they're going to try and do with it.
Listen, Pan Am Airlines right. did the same thing.
Eastern, too.
Yeah. Did both finally give it up also?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I figured as much. Hold that thought for just 1 millisecond,
sure.
Okay? So we won't be having a guest speaker. She decided she wanted to leave, so I just have to go open and close the door. Oh, no, see, sure. Folks, the great thing about having a podcast and a show like this, we can actually do this while we're broadcasting because it's intimate, it's cozy, it's just a couple of friends talking. We're sharing this with you, and hey, you're part of the ride as well. So, and if you've got cats, you know the deal.
Right. I saw something else this week that our friends north of the border are going through right now, because you remember when they built Mall of America and then that in Minnesota, and then all of a sudden there was the, what is it, West Edmonton Mall? That's that massive behemoth that's in Western Canada now that is run by the same people that made Mall of America. So now they've tried one in Calgary. And I don't know if it's the same company doing it, but they built one of these mega mall monstrosities with like 500 retail spaces in it. And as of the airing of this or the recording of it, they had 11 of them filled and expected 39 more, which means they're going to be, if I do the math right, 90% empty.
Well, first of all, it's a dumb idea to put it in the same, what do you call it?
Oh, in the same province?
Yeah. I mean, Edmonton and Calgary, why didn't you put one in Ottawa?
Right.
Or, you know, the capital city, or Toronto, a place that's heavily populated where it would make more sense.
Right. Or, you know, even Vancouver. If you're stuck on going into Western Canada, go all the way west and into British Columbia.
Yeah, I don't get it. But, you know, the thing is, here, right here, you know, we have the oncoming. I'm sure I've bemoaned the fact that we have this retail outlet mall opening up right down the street from me. Now, it's supposed to be a draw for, of course, tourists, which that's a completely different tirade that would probably take up an entire show on its own merits.
Tourists are going to come to New York to go to the mall. Okay.
To the John, I kid you not, the illogic. First of all, just to very quickly do this, because I know I'll go off on a tangent and you probably won't be able to contain me, but the way that the New York City government always handles Staten Island is they never know what they're doing. And that's not a joke. And I'm not being flip, believe me. It sticks in my craw on a constant basis because they don't know anything about Staten Island. As it is with that asshole de Blasio who openly treats Staten Island with contempt, their whole thing, anytime that an idea may be mooted, is let's throw enough shit at the wall and see what's bound to stick when it comes to Staten Island. So, of course, they came up with the idea of the New York Eye, which is the equivalent of the London Eye, the Ferris wheel. Guess what? It's not happening. That is a red herring disaster that has gone down in flames. Probably within the next 2 weeks, you're going to hear that they're going to have to auction off the few parts that are there.
That's brilliant. So is de Blasio's problem with Staten Island as simple as the fact that that's where all the cops live?
That it's Republican-based, okay. That they didn't vote for him, and the fact that he also treats parts of the Bronx and a lot of Brooklyn like they're no different than Staten Island.
Okay.
He's very centered around Manhattan and nothing else, and his own neighborhood in Brooklyn. That's it. Nothing else. Queens also is kind of irrelevant to him. He's just that myopic. But anyway, hand in hand with the Ferris wheel disaster – we have this outlet mall, Empire Outlets, going up right against, physically against, built up against the ferry terminal. It's hard enough with physical car traffic and the foot traffic that comes in and out of the ferry as it is. This is going to be a disaster of epic proportions. Now, they say that it's basically 99% filled with, you know, high-end names. First of all, why do we need high-end names in this neighborhood? This is not that kind of area. This is a family-based area. It's middle class, if there is still a middle class. We have this It keeps getting delayed. It's being delayed now until spring of 2019. Okay. Meanwhile, the Staten Island Mall, the one mall that we've had all along since 1972, has gotten a complete refurbishing yet again. And they've built this entire new food court that they're touting to the skies. I mean, I'm sorry, Dave and Buster's, Shake Shack, and Chipotle do not equate fine dining to me in a mall setting.
Not to mention, I mean, if that's what you're getting excited about, oh boy, a food court. Oh.
Well, the mall doesn't, we don't even have a Gap on Staten Island anymore. The Gap that was in the mall, which was there from the time they opened, is gone. They've got Baby Gap and they've got Gap Body. Don't have Banana Republic. I malls are going the way of the dodo.
Right.
We've had that conversation, and it just puzzles me how people will still continue to invest in something that is inevitably not going to pay dividends.
Right. And I think it's probably because the people who build the malls are insured either way. Because if the thing fails and goes under, they can take a massive tax write-off and they don't have to be responsible for the ground. That's something we haven't mentioned in all of this discussion is how many of these malls, and there is one here in the area on the north side of St. Louis, that are abandoned and they're just sitting there rotting away. There's a guy, as a matter of fact, a few years back who did a book. Photography book of nothing but the insides of abandoned malls with a few pictures interspersed of what they look like in their heyday. And it's frightening. And they're everywhere and they're massive and they're usually toxic and nobody wants to clean them up or knock them down and it's expensive. So they just sit there and molder.
Out of idle curiosity, have you ever been to a mall that's on the verge of closing? Because I have,
Oh,
and it's
yeah.
very weird and very creepy. I was in this, I don't remember the name of it, and I'm sure it's been knocked down since. I was in Orlando at one of the earliest malls that they had, and it was right before they were closing the last stores down. The girl I was dating at the time took me there, and it was a very weird and eerie, because it was already kind of dark,
Right. Yeah,
you
it's
know,
like
with
they
so
shut
many
half the
businesses.
lights off.
Yeah, I mean, because of so many businesses not there.
Yep, and there's
There were
no.
maybe a few, you know, and that was it, like a barber shop and, you know, a 1 hour photo place and, you know, a little cheap trinkets kind of thing. And that it looked more like a flea market setting, really.
That's actually what they ended up doing with the one in Tampa that I used to go to all the time that eventually failed. And they made a flea market out of it. And even as a flea market, there was that same sort of dark desperation and creepiness that just permeated out of the walls. It was exactly as you described. But that's, for the people that are there at the few remaining stores, one of the ones that they had at Floraland Mall was a daycare. It was one of these places where you didn't have to be a member or anything. You just, if you wanted to ditch your kids for a couple hours, you pay them $50 and your kids play video games for 3 hours. It was that kind of weird.
Jesus, I don't know. I barely ever need to go to any kind of malls to begin with,
Right.
so, which is, you know, I'm no different than anybody else. Let's put it that way. I shop online now mainly because I don't have the time
Yep.
and I don't have the patience for the crowds. You know, I don't think that makes me a bad person that I choose not to go to the mall. And you know, it's also the age too. You know, I'm just too old for mall life. I used to refer to the mall actually as the Staten Island. The Staten Island Youth Culture Center. So
Right. And
once.
it isn't anymore. It isn't for them either. And that's the thing is that, the reason why Amazon is successful is not because, their deals are that much better or anything else like that. It's just that there aren't any people there. I can go to Amazon to get everything I need and never interact with another human being.
You know, the older I get, the more I like that.
Yep, that's what I'm saying.
I like the fact. I'll give you a perfect example. This Saturday was so tiring. Just from the moment that I got up, that we kind of looked at each other and said, I don't really feel like going out today. I don't feel like, you know, going out and having lunch or dealing with idiots at the grocery store. Let's just stay in. And with the exception of the few words that I would exchange with Liz, because I've met her before, you know, I didn't have to talk to a single human being, and it felt great.
Yeah.
You know,
So,
I love Days of Solitude.
yep, and I think that's more than anything is why we're seeing them all start to go the way of all flesh, because we just would rather not deal with it. If we want to go somewhere and deal with people, as I did, and one of the things we're going to talk about in just a couple of minutes is one of those outings, then I know where to go, and I know where to go where there are people who I'm going to be okay with, you know, and not have to deal with total idiots. So, as we move from there into...
Want to go somewhere? Knows your name.
yeah, kinda. But you know, I guess the same could be.
John!
Wait, why am I all of a sudden Norm? I can't be Cliffy.
So, in other words, you want to have somebody, you know, just rearing to punch you out for being a know-it-all?
Pretty much, yeah. That's what I'm going for. That's what I aim for in life. But, no, there's been a ton of happening in the world of politics, of course. Judge Kavanaugh is now Justice Kavanaugh, and all of the machinations as we all knew. And that's, to me, the most hateful thing about this entire process is we knew going in, this was nothing was going to change. This was a foregone conclusion. Exactly what was going to happen when the votes came down is what we knew was going to happen. And what did we do? What did we spend 2 weeks doing?
Posturing.
Oh boy.
What was it? Just posturing and feeding the flames of frenzy and people overreacting and being as predictable and dislikable as possible. On all sides. The one thing I will say about this whole process is very simply, in the grand scheme of things, especially for those in our age bracket, his appointment doesn't affect us in any way, shape, or form.
Nope.
It really doesn't.
Right.
You know, right. Our lives have gone on from the time that Clarence Thomas came in with all the hemming and hawing about him, all of the big deals that they made about Alito and Roberts, and what happened? Nothing. And oh yeah, with somebody like Roberts on the bench, they managed to pass the Marriage Equality Act.
Not only that, you know? Yeah, keep in mind Roberts was the deciding vote on the Affordable Care Act. There wouldn't have been Obamacare had there not been John Roberts on the court.
Right. So it's a case of once again, really, and I'm saying this in absolute seriousness and complete disgust. This was a dog and pony show driven by the Democrats and feeding, like I said, the flames of frenzy for people to get worked up and lathered up and start screaming. And at the same time, of course, getting off topic and, you know, saying shit like, you know, free Palestine. You know, this is enough already. Right. You fucking left wing lunatics need to be dealt with. And I'm telling you right now, when they wake up on November 7th, they're going to sit there and go, what the fuck happened?
Yeah.
What they have done, you're not going to have the loud, bombastic reactions like with the Democrats, with the Republicans. They've pissed off the Republicans. So they're silently going to go and actually vote. Because let's not forget, Democrats love to scream, but they don't like to actually do the legwork and go out and vote.
Right. Which is, again, one of the most hateful things you could think of, because they're the ones who bitch the loudest about absolutely everything and never do anything about it.
And
so it's been, oh God, so it's been 20 years since we've heard a Democrat who had an original idea.
I'll tell you what, I've had my fill of the nonsense that keeps getting spewed forth. It's a broken record. It really is. The needle is stuck and it's just the same dribble. Over and over again. So whether people like what I'm saying, you know what, you take it for what it's worth. It's a fact, because we're just looking at it from the common sense point of view.
Right.
You know, I'm looking at all of it from the periphery. And people, what I find so disturbing is that there a lot of the castigations against Kavanaugh are that he believes in the Constitution and the letter of the law. I don't know if people remember this idea, but that's what laws are there for. That's the point. It's for sake of order and balance. And God knows if I was a lawyer, and there are times I, especially as I've gotten older, that I regret not having become a lawyer, because as I've been told many, many times in my life, you could talk the horns off a goat. I maintain that if I were a lawyer, I would indeed be fighting for the letter of the law.
Yeah, well,
I'm going to spin a very, very small and brief anecdote, and it's not meant to be funny because I wasn't being funny when the conversation came up. This is going back to 2007, when the first words of gay marriage started to come up, and it became a quick hot button topic. And I said very simply, because I'm looking at the Constitution, I'm also looking at states' rights. And let's not forget, that was the real cause of the Civil War. It wasn't slavery, it was states' rights. If you go by definition and dictionary, a marriage is a legal, moral, emotional contract. Keyword contract, which is a legal thing between a man and a woman. Period. That is the dictionary definition of marriage in 2007. And my argument was, and because that is the definition, you cannot rewrite the dictionary. So you cannot create a law for something that does not exist. I was all for civil unions from the get-go because, you know, people have been together for years and years. They absolutely have every right to have, you know, each other's backs in terms of insurance and so on and so forth. Just like anybody else, like you, like me, you know, like anyone, because what a person's sexual preference is not important. But that's another story entirely, because that too has become suddenly a focal point for more nonsense. But the point is that my argument that you could not give credibility to the notion of gay marriage is simply by virtue of definition. You know, and a good lawyer is going to go and parse all of that.
Right. But a good lawyer shouldn't have the opportunity, because if marriage is indeed that, then it should have stayed with religion. Let religion have marriage. Like you said, keep the state out of it entirely. And if they're not going to have, you know, if it's not going to be available to everybody, the state has no interest in it.
Exactly. And then the thing is, it's all about following the letter of definition.
Right.
Which is what becomes the letter of the law. Period. There was also, of course, I made a very good counter argument that, you know, if you open up the doors to gay marriage, then you're going to have, and I hate to say it, you're going to have the real sickos coming out saying, well, you know, I'm in love with my chicken. I want to marry my chicken, because you have these lunatics out there, you know, and of course you've got the NAMBLA bastards out there having the audacity to say, well, what about us? What about you? You don't have any rights. You don't deserve anything except to be imprisoned, let alone taken out and executed. But I digress.
That's okay. I forgot where we were. Oh, yeah, Kavanaugh. So and the thing is, look,
order in the court.
Is Brett Kavanaugh a grown-up version of a snotty asshole frat boy son of a bitch? Yes. Yes, he is. That's exactly what he is, right down the line. Is there anything you could accuse him of that I would say, no, he couldn't possibly do that? Nope. I don't know if he did this, but there's nothing that would surprise me about this asshole. So now he's an asshole on the Supreme Court. He's not the first. He won't be the last, and we'll survive him too.
But see, John, you're talking logic. How many times do I have to tell you? When you talk common sense and logic, it gets people riled up because they don't know what that is.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
the only thing that people, especially on the left, know is what the problem is, quote unquote, and I'm using the problem in quotation marks, and who's to blame. And you can point it at the man whose everything is huge. So everything is Trump's fault, you know.
Oh, and everybody. Yeah. And part of it really is that sour grapes, because listen, nobody knows better than I do how lousy it feels to come this close to getting what you were supposed to get all along, only to have it ripped away from you at the end. I'm a Bills fan. So if you can't deal with that kind of disappointment, then don't watch sports. Now, there were a couple of, we've got to talk a little bit of music, because there's so much going on musically, and then we'll get to In Our Heads, and we've got plenty more coming, but we got to go out and see a concert. Now, I don't remember the last time we talked about a concert you went to. When was the last time you actually saw music live somewhere?
Probably January, when I saw the Posies acoustic show. It wasn't so much the band; it was John and Ken doing that amazing set at City Winery.
Yeah.
So it's been 10 months.
10 months, yeah, which is far too long, and I know you think so too. But we got an invitation. Just over the last couple of weeks, a buddy of mine called me up and he said, what are you doing Wednesday night? I'll get back to the Wednesday night part of this, but upshot was it was an invitation to go see the MC5 on the MC50, the 50th anniversary tour, and jumped at it because we talked about this when I did it. I interviewed Wayne Kramer back when this tour was first announced and was excited about it then. So we went to the show. Let me start with the MC50s part of this, because the band that he's put together around him is full of some amazing players from different bands. But the show itself was outstanding. The music was fantastic. It was a small room. And when I say small room, I'm going to estimate 350, maybe 400 max capacity. And it was mostly full on a Wednesday night, which says a lot. But Wayne Kramer, he doesn't move around the stage as well as he used to, but you know what? Nobody moves as well as they used to 50 years ago. But he was much more animated than I expected him to be and killed it. I mean, the voice is still there. It was still the same raw energy that you would expect out of the MC5, and it was brilliant. It sounded so good, which I was really happy about. What I wasn't so happy about is that they didn't hit the stage until 20 minutes after 11. On a Friday night, on a Saturday night, I'm fine with this, but there were three opening acts, and that's too many, and each of them went on for a fairly decent period of time. We didn't even see the first two. We came in late because we knew it was going to be a while, and when we came in, the third opener was just taking the stage, and that was right at 10 o'clock. So, you know, they played a good set. They were fine. But still, on a Wednesday night, I don't want to see a concert like that kick off with a headliner after 11 o'clock. It's just, it's too damn much. And everybody's got to get up in the morning. It sucks, but it's true.
You know, the last time I saw a show that had an opening act, first of all, the band went on at exactly 8 o'clock and we weren't even in the seats yet.
Right.
But the opening act was the Pretenders opening up for Stevie Nicks.
Wow.
Which is still the most ponderous, you know, couplings, but in hindsight, it was a perfect pairing. And, you know, as we talked about on the old Overnight America, you want to talk about an outstanding show. And Jesus Christ, Stevie Nicks on her own can hold it. You know, it just phenomenal. But Jesus, the Pretenders sounded, first of all, Martin Chambers playing drums is still a joy to see after 38 years. Since we first saw the Pretenders, that guy can just slam those skins like nobody's business. And they sounded as on point as the records did. I had only one grievance the entire time during the Pretender set, because I hadn't seen them since 81. So just think, the last time I saw them was with the half the band alive, you know, the original lineup. They didn't do Kid. That's the only song I would have loved to have seen them do live once more, you know. But
yeah.
Hey, I saw them do it back in 81. But please continue.
You know, I was just going to say that, you know, I don't regret for a minute that I went, but I've got an hour drive back from the concert venue. So yeah, I mean, not coming home until after 1 o'clock in the morning. Again, I used to be 20.
After a concert, you would go out.
Right.
You know, the night was 1 o'clock is nothing.
Yep.
And then by the time you get home, if you went to sleep, and that's a big if you went to sleep, you took maybe a 2-hour nap, you got up, you went to school, went to work after school, and then did it all over again the next night.
Yeah. But I was happy to see that there were a bunch of kids there who were 20. So that was kind of cool as well.
Well, that's a good thing. Yeah. Because if you know, to see the younger generation being hipped to this music, it's important.
Yeah. Right. If for no
it
other
keeps
reason.
It alive.
Right. And they've got to know where their stuff came from too. So, but it did its job. And I would recommend to anybody, if you get the chance to see them while they're out on this tour, take it. It's well worth the effort to go and check them out.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm glad that you went. I'm glad that it was a great show. I'm glad that you had a good time. And I hope you got some sleep afterwards when all is said and done.
Yeah, a little bit.
At least substantial sleep.
Yeah.
You know, enough to get you through the day.
Right. And, you know, as far as recorded music goes, I know you've been waiting and waiting and waiting to talk about this one because the album hit your desk a little while ago, but we were really excited about the first couple of offerings from this band, Poppy Lux. What have they got in the latest one?
Okay, the latest one, which is actually titled Lumiere, it's – and just to give folks a background, because I don't think we've actually had a chance to talk about Populux since we started Radio City. We started talking about this band from the time you and I started getting together back in 2013. They're a band that are Brooklyn-based, driven by the incredible Rob Shapiro. The band that draws the most comparisons to, as much as I don't like doing it, you can't help but almost immediately notice it. Style-wise, sonically, like the production style. So hats off to being able to approximate a particular producer's sound. XTC.
Yes.
Plus, a lot of the Beatles and Todd Rundgren are in there. Or certainly Utopia's, you know, Todd Rundgren's later years in Utopia. The new album, Lumiere, is just, it's devastating. That's how good it is. Because, first of all, as much as I am feeling very, what's a diplomatic word? Not quite generous towards political anything right now. The band has gotten much more sociopolitical in their lyrics, but they're very well thought out. They're fully realized. You know, these aren't half-baked gestures that a lot of writers will take to at a time when it's convenient. You know, this is somebody who's a very mature, focused, knowledgeable writer. You know, he doesn't suffer fools gladly in conversation, and he sure as shit doesn't do it lyrically either. And when he flowers on lyrics, forget it. He's a master. He really is. We're very lucky that somebody like him is putting out music from an American perspective right now. And Populux shouldn't be flying under the radar. That's why I want to give them as much exposure as possible. The fact is, you know, one of the tracks that kicks off the record, Lady Liberty, which I think you and I may have talked about when we premiered the video for it on Popdose last year. It's one of those magic moments. You know, it's melody, structure, skill, and knowing how to flesh the whole thing out, and yet doing it less is more. It's not, they don't overplay. They're a trio to begin with. But they make it big and fat within the framework of guitar, bass, and drums. We can become anything we want. Oh, it's the freedom of what they say. Coronet is bruised by false love. All of children of dreams are far away. See you in your heart. Yeah, of course there are nuances. And there are embellishments and supplemental instruments to help, you know, fill in the little colors. Look at it like you got to look at the music of Populux like a canvas. And you look at it being painted. And that's how they do this. They paint in the main colors, the main portions of the canvas, and then they flesh it in with all the little colors. And it's wonderful, you know. Garage Sale, which was another one that we talked about. No question, that's definitely Black Sea era XTC at its best. Kind of reminds me of Travels in Nylon or Paper and Iron, Notes and Coins, which, you know, those are two of the songs that I really like most on that. That's overall, you know, it's my sentimental favorite XTC album. But, you know, I think Rob has studied the Beatles and XTC's work so well that he's made it his own.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't become like a parody. It doesn't become British. You know, he doesn't start singing in an Andy Partridge kind of yelp, you know. Thank God, because only I can do that and not hate myself for it, because it's an inevitability. Mm-hmm. But the thing is also there are riffs galore, and the way the album sounds, it's got that Steve Lillywhite patented drum whack, you know, that explosiveness, you know, and that propulsive bass that's locked right into the drums. So that's another key factor. What? The funniest thing is that I think the one song on this album that I like the most is called How Long's It Gonna Take? It's 8 minutes and 3 seconds, okay, I think. It's like the magnum opus. And I know it's got to be a spoof because all it is them – it's a dancey kind of riff. It's kind of got a Pop Will Eat Itself kind of mechanical vibe. And all they're doing is chanting over and over again, how long's it going to take? You know, but they do it in a funky way. And there are horn punches in here, not dissimilar to Rehab by Amy Winehouse. It's brilliant. I mean, you want to talk about really hitting the mark with no lyrics? It's sheer genius. Yeah. And I mean sheer genius.
Well, like you said, when the lyrics do come in, they're on point and they're thoughtful. The thing that got me about this is that, first of all, sonically, they're way tighter than we've heard them before. The harmonies are tighter and more coherent. And it's not that they were loose or incoherent before. It's just that they're that much better with this album. And the other thing that struck me about it is that the levels and layers of influence in this one go beyond just the Beatles and XTC. They're certainly there. But you also hear a little bit of Pink Floyd. Early Floyd, when they were still experimental and weird, I heard a little bit of a Simon and Garfunkel kind of sound on one of the early tracks. It might have been Schoolyard.
Only, even standing here, even waiting here. Only, waiting by yourself. Singing to yourself.
It's not a rip of any of those things, but it's a very comfortable place to be for me musically because it's growing up stuff and it doesn't sound dated. It doesn't sound old. It sounds like they know what that was and they're going to use it as part of what they're doing.
Right. Well, that's when you use your influences the right way. When, yep. You know, somebody can say, hey, that kind of reminds me of. You know, it may not have been a conscious thing, but the fact is when you're able to meld that into your own work and yet still have that drawn out from it, then you're hitting the marks dead on. And, you know, I just think this album, and as you said, you know, they sound tighter than ever. This is such a natural progression in the genesis of this band, and that's what makes it so special.
Yep.
Never mind the fact that I have an emotional investment in this band because I've liked them from the moment that I first heard them, and that's already, you know, 4 years down the road, but this is a magnificent piece of work. This is one of those albums that if you're in a band and, you know, you put out another record or two and you hang it up afterwards, you can always look back at that one album and say, yeah, but we did that.
Yes, definitely. One of those moments and something that you've got to grab. I mean, this has to be part of your collection, no doubt about it.
Absolutely. So people, take heed to what we say. Buy this record. Go out, find it, buy it, because if not, we will find you.
Now, it's rare that I pat myself on the back for something that I didn't do on my radio show, but I've got to do it at least once during our conversation here because I'm going to pat myself on the back for the fact that over the last 7 days, I did not play Red Red Wine as bumper music on my radio show. And I'm probably the only talk show host in the country who didn't. So I want you to know there was somebody who bucked that trend.
Well, first of all, 90% of assholes don't even know that that's a fucking Neil Diamond
song. Yeah, I know.
And that it's a country song by Neil Diamond. If you hear the original version,
yep.
Cue the music, please.
But with time, thoughts of you would leave my head. I was wrong, and I find just one thing.
I hate UB40 because they're a bunch of Jew haters. So I've got nothing good to say about them. Neil better be getting big fat checks. Isn't it ironic their most well-known song happened to be written by, yeah.
Yes.
Come on, just but you know it's funny because it sent me last week into listening to nothing but good old Neil Diamond stuff, you know, including his magnificent version of Red Red Wine. People, if you really want to get a gist of what Neil Diamond was truly about and how amazing he was in just a year span from 1966 to late 1967, go out and pick up immediately the Bang Years. It's got all the tracks he recorded for Bang Records, and that would include, going in no particular order, Solitary Man, Cherry Cherry, Girl You'll Be a Woman Soon, Shiloh, which the original proper version of Shiloh, which if you're not in tears by the end when that toy piano comes in, forget it. Oh, God, I cannot listen to – I've never made it through that song without getting teary. We used to try to cover it, and I couldn't get through it. I would start bawling every time. You know, it's one of those songs that just moves you. But Kentucky Woman, The Boat That I Row, You'll Forget, and, of course, Red, Red Wine, which is just beyond – oh, and the original version of Love to Love, which was recorded at the same time but never released until much later on by the Monkees. So, you know, and both versions are pretty amazing. His is a little more lower voltage, but it's more intense. Davey did a fantastic job on the Monkees version, you know, because it's really powerful.
Yeah.
But Neil Diamond is truly a gift and was then and still is now. So fuck you, UB40.
Now we got to talk a little Tube as well. I did something this week, and I don't remember if we talked at all about the Looming Tower last week.
I think you mentioned it.
Yeah,
because I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, it's a thing where it's the years leading up to, like, from the bombing of the Cole through the downing of the Twin Towers, and thus the Looming Tower. But it's the battle between the CIA and the FBI. Because remember, that was a big deal. When September 11th happened, they said, oh, the FBI and the CIA weren't sharing any information. Well, it goes into the personality conflicts that led to that. And this is not a documentary. This is a drama. And Jeff Daniels plays the FBI guy. And the cast is great. And the action is good. The problem that I have with it is that I still have a block when it comes to play acting around September 11th. You know what I mean? It's still too big a thing for me. Yeah. And I can't imagine how it is for somebody who lived in New York during that, that I, you know, I didn't see the movie Twin Towers. I didn't see a number of movies that came out after that. And there weren't that many, considering the magnitude of what happened that day. There were not that many movies that were dedicated to this. But I don't remember any of them doing really all that well. And I think it's because people like me just get a little, I don't know, there's something about it that says I shouldn't be watching somebody who wrote a drama series about what happened that day.
I have to admit, when it comes to 9/11, I always avoid it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I won't watch because, excuse me, there's something that's always inherently offensive thrown in there. It's hard to put into words. And I'm not sure it's because, you know, I was in the city when it all happened, on my way to work, because it was such a surreal and just, you know, it was just a surreal day. And kind of hard to, you remember all the details of it because the shock, once the shock wore off and you're able to kind of, if you weren't there, you don't know, you know, and you don't know the immediate aftermath either, you know. Just for the sake, and you know, it's not about me, but I can just tell you from my perspective, I couldn't move off the floor once we got home.
Yeah.
Now, we made it back in time because the city closed down. We were on literally the last subway and then the last buses that would cross over the Verrazano Bridge to get us back on Staten Island because the ferry had been shut down to make a makeshift morgue over in the ferry terminal on this side.
Yeah. See, and that's part of the reason why, because those are the things that you know, that reality of that day is something that you can't capture without, you know, using the footage of what happened. And I just, you can't do it. You can't write that story.
No, you can't make it a story.
Yeah.
It is a reality.
Yeah. So it's tough.
And well, I mean, what's
so far so good. I mean, it's very well done, and they haven't, granted to their credit, up until this point, I have not seen any footage or any dramatization of the actual events. It's all, it's the search for information, trying to figure out what's coming. It's like everybody there knows something's coming, but they have no idea what it is and no idea how to stop it. So it's at least real as far as that goes, but it's like watching an episode of Law and Order that's leading up to September 11th.
Well, I'll tell you what, though, if Jeff Daniels is in it, it must be worth the price of admission, because
he's great.
He was the lead in one of my all-time favorite series, The Newsroom.
Yep.
I watched that show religiously. I actually bought it on DVD. That's how much I love that show. There's just he's magnificent. He really is just such a talent.
Right. And he's playing a similar character, not quite as sanctimonious, but he's playing a similar type. So, yeah, it's something that he does very well anyway. And like you said, he's an incredibly talented guy. So if that's not a block you have, I would say definitely watch it. You're going to get a lot out of it. Now, you've been watching. Go ahead.
Yeah, the Deuce.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to say, yeah. Unfortunately, it did lose me. It did. It's just I said when I watched the first two episodes that this was the exact opposite of what last year was. The attention to detail, the care. This has become like vinyl. It's just sloppy now. It's really sloppy. And I don't foresee it getting a third season. There's no way it can sustain. Yeah. I swear to you, John, it almost seems like even the performers know that, okay, this is not really working. It's not the way it worked last year. They're mailing it in, and it's ridiculous.
Well,
it really is.
We're seeing that happen a ton. I mean, just over the last week, we're starting to see now the streamers who had so much success with original series, starting with Netflix and then, followed up by Amazon and then Hulu, with making original series that were funny and entertaining and well done and well written and acted by movie stars who were going, leaving the big screens and going and making these streaming series. You can tick off a list 20 names long without really thinking about it too much. So they were doing very well for the first couple of years, and then they decided, wow, that's really expensive. And a whole bunch of those series have been axed by Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, and some of them are going to be picked back up, I'm sure, by maybe even some of the regular broadcast TV networks. But as it stands right now, the shine is really gone from that, and it didn't take long. So I'm waiting to see how the streamers recover from that, with all of these series getting canceled and all these people being fired.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny because last week they finally announced. Now, keep in mind how long we've been talking about this. Outcast is finished.
Yep.
It took a year and a half to broadcast season two. Now, the show was renewed for a second season before it ever premiered. According to all the stories, one, it didn't do well in the ratings. Number two, it was expensive to make. Okay. Number three, Cinemax/HBO really fucked up royally by doing that whole thing. If they wanted to go back to the whole action series thing that made Friday Night successful, that's why they gave the hook to Quarry and to Outcast. But in reality, it's the cheapness of doing a co-production, which is why most of the shows that were on Friday nights are always, HBO Cinemax in conjunction with, for instance, Strike Back is in conjunction with Sky TV in England. Get somebody else to help foot the bill, and we can put on a show.
Yep.
Really sloppy work by HBO and Showtime and HBO and Cinemax. But again, with an original series like The Deuce, you've got all these talents. You've got somebody like James Franco who works his ass off. And for what? This thing is just now – it's not as abhorrent as vinyl was, because vinyl was shit right out of the gate. There's no way around that. But no, I couldn't care less now. So, it left me flat.
Yeah. And on the subject of not caring less, maybe again, this is me being an old man yelling at clouds, but am I the only one between the two of us who, even after all of the pre-hype and after all of the massive buzz that's happened since this movie opened, who just doesn't give a shit about going to see A Star Is Born?
Oh, you think I give a fuck?
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay, John, first of all, two words, Streisand.
Uh-huh.
Christofferson.
Right.
Okay, that's number one. Number two, I can't stand Lady Gaga, you know? Period. Third, the only thing Bradley Cooper ever says in a movie is, "What the fuck?" in all the Hangover films.
Right.
And that's it. And without Jennifer Lawrence, he's nothing.
And even in that movie, all he said was, "What the fuck?" So, yeah.
The stars, but you know, it's like, this is what you've come up with?
Yeah.
Seriously, this is the fourth fucking remake of this movie.
Right. And even
and
what I remember from when it came out when I was a kid, the Streisand version of A Star Is Born, is that, first of all, I did not go see it. I remember hearing that stupid Evergreen song for an entire summer. You want to talk about a puke-inducing piece of music. Oh, my God. And I just remember the entire vibe around it being so... oh, so overwrought and overwhelmed with, oh, it's the greatest thing ever. And as soon as it was gone out of theaters, everybody forgot. Nobody gave a shit anymore. So it's got zero staying power. Nobody is going back and you're saying, oh, A Star Is Born is out. You should go back and watch the one from 1970, blah, blah, blah. Because no, you shouldn't.
Here's the only thing I will say, and then we can move on to In Our Heads, because and I'm sure you know this, but... do you know the original lead, male lead chosen was Elvis Presley?
No, I didn't.
He was asked to do it, and he said yes. He said yes. He wanted to do it because this would be, first of all, it was already at this point, what, 5 years since that ghastly change of habit, which was his last movie overall. He wanted to be taken seriously as an actor. Because of Colonel Tom, he couldn't do the movie. Why? Because he wouldn't get top billing. He didn't give a shit about top billing. Let Barbara Streisand have the top billing. He wanted to do the movie to show that he could actually act.
Oh, okay.
You know, because it was a drama, a straight dramatic role. It wasn't a vehicle for his cheesy songs, you know? And simply because of Colonel Tom saying, if you're not getting the top billing, then I'm not sending you out there. I don't care. Even though he said, yes, I will do it. I will take less money. I want to do this movie. And he never forgave Colonel Tom, apparently. That was like the breaking point between the two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they still had a business relationship, but that was like, you've interfered one time too many. I can make my own decisions.
And one last, before we get to In Our Heads, on the subject of Elvis movies, an Elvis-related movie celebrated an anniversary. You know, it has now been 15 years since the release of Bubba Ho-Tep.
I've seen that once.
I love that movie so much.
Once. You are a twisted, twisted individual. I'm finally finding this out 5 years after the fact.
Oh,
unbelievable.
Yeah.
I always thought, you know, in this little duo that, you know, you were the straight man and I was the comedic relief, or the surly relief, as it were. But I'm finding out you're the twisted fuck and I'm the straight man.
Hey, yeah. You know.
I'm not sure I know how to feel about it.
Either way works for me. But as we get into In Our Heads, now is the time when I am going to brag a little bit and pat my own self on the back for something that we did on the radio show this week, because our Music Monday guest from today is a legend. And I didn't have very long to talk to her, but it was for the greatest of reasons, because her new album is a gem. Ann Wilson from Heart, it has a new album out, and it's called Immortal, and it's kind of a concept record, but not in the traditional sense. The concept behind it is that she was, in effect, doing the same thing we've been doing for the last 2 years, which is watching all of the names that meant something to her die out of the world of rock and roll. And, I mean, certainly headlined by Tom Petty and others of that ilk, but, you know, to see so many of these people who wrote these immortal pieces of music, David Bowie and Tom Petty and the rest of them, she decided to take her favorites from each one of those artists and make a covers record with sort of redone versions of some of her favorites from those people, Leonard Cohen, George Michael. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And so I thought, to sort of celebrate that idea, because I think it's a great idea, by the way, and the execution is fantastic. The band sounds great.
I think that's a terrific concept. And don't forget, you know, when I went to that awful David Bowie tribute concert, she was one of the very few things, if not the best thing, on that stage that night. Unfortunately marred by a shitty sound system. And you've got one of the greatest voices in rock and roll right there on the stage. And, you know, they just did not serve her with justice whatsoever.
That's too bad. But yeah, get the record. It's well worth the get. But as we go through in our heads, I want to go down the list of people that she drew from. And we don't have to do all of them, but at least to take a couple of the highlights and ask you if you were going to do a record where you were going to sing one of these songs, which one you would go after. And we can start with George Michael.
Any song by George Martin?
Any song George by George Michael? If you were going to cover it yourself, which one would you pick?
My automatic trigger reaction would be probably Young Guns Go For It, but no. If I was going to pick anything by George Michael, it would probably be Everything She Wants.
Choice, definitely.
It's a great song. It was one of the first songs that he had written that I felt was timely, you know, in the sense that it was very mature. You know, you're in a relationship with somebody who's just, what now do you want from me? And I love that song because of it.
Yeah.
Freedom was one of my favorite songs by Wham. And so is Careless Whisper, but I think Everything She Wants would be the one I would do.
See, and I went Praying for Time, and for a similar reason, because I think as in yours, he matured as a lyricist. In Praying for Time, it really was a maturation of the music. It wasn't just the same pop drivel that we had heard from him in earlier iterations. And I mean, he was a pop singer, so of course you are. But Praying for Time, you know, sonically, it meant something a little bit more to me than some of the earlier stuff.
Okay. Next one.
Next one. Leonard Cohen. She went with and by the way, on George Michael, she went with a different corner. But with Leonard Cohen, she took 1,000 Kisses Deep. So when it comes to the Cohen catalog, which one sticks out to you?
I remember it well in the Chelsea Hotel. You were giving me head on the unmade bed. But I would probably, you know, I would probably do either Chelsea Hotel or I would really do a good version of First We Take Manhattan, because R.E.M. just fucked that all up.
And you took mine, you bastard. Because and the reason that I would, I would go after First We Take Manhattan is kind of the opposite of the George Michael thing, because the music is so much poppier than Leonard Cohen ever really was. And yet his vocals take it in exactly the opposite direction. It's speak singing for most of it. And then he is just as dark and is just in that corner as you could possibly hear Leonard Cohen be.
And I don't like these drugs that keep you thin. I don't like what happened to my sister. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
Over this almost sappy sounding music, it's a very strange cut, but I love it.
As long as I don't hear another fucking version of Hallelujah or Tower of Song, I'm fine.
Right. Okay, fair enough. So,
I don't need to hear anybody.
Yeah.
Anybody covering those two songs.
So again, yeah, she went with 1,000 Kisses Deep. The next artist on the album on track 3 is one that I have to admit here, again, being an old man yelling at a cloud, I'm not as familiar with Amy Winehouse's catalog as a lot of people are, but I do have a favorite. So what's yours?
I don't really know her stuff that well, so I can't qualify on that one, believe it or not.
Same boat, like I said, but there was a song that I think one of my kids introduced me to about 5 or 6 years ago called Love is a Losing Game. And again, it's done in that very retro chanteuse, you know, early to mid 50s style. And she just flat nails it in that song. It's great. It's a nice piece of music.
Okay.
Next one. And she went with, did I say Back to Black was the one that she picked off of that one? Jerry Rafferty died this year. Oh. And, you know,
I would probably do Right Down the Line.
Great choice. She took Baker Street, obviously, because it's Jerry Rafferty, and it's the easiest one to think of.
Well, no. I mean, Stuck in the Middle is the first one that comes to mind.
That's the one I would do. Yeah. And I don't know how many people really associate him. I mean, he was Steeler's Wheel, but I don't know how widely known that is outside of really, you know, music student kind of circles.
There's also a great song that they had called Star But yeah, I just always love Right Down the Line. Great, great song.
Yep. She went, yeah, again with Baker Street. And I'm going to skip a couple here. And we've got to talk David Bowie. She did, and again, this is...
Oh, there's no question, because I've often fantasized about doing a proper version. I would do Love You Till Tuesday.
Nice, nice. Well, the absolutely. One she...
You know, with the orchestra,
yeah.
The single version, not the album version. You know, the single version is the one with where he sounds more like Anthony Newley.
Right.
But I don't care. I there is a part of me that loves that kind of, I would say theatrical, not exactly Broadway, but I love that kind of stuff. That's why I love Scott Walker. You know, the fact that he could come out and deliver something like Matilda or Jackie, you know, doing the Jacques Brel songs, or then, you know, sing something as dark and foreboding like Montague Street in Blue. But Bowie's earliest stuff in the 60s, that's the stuff I love the most. So if I was going to do, or I would definitely do You've Got a Habit of Leaving Me, which is maybe his third single.
Yeah.
Sounds like The Who. I'd go with that. It's good, but it would definitely be Love You Till Tuesday.
And
no
she,
question.
And Ann Wilson on her record on Immortal, she went in a very pointed direction. She took I'm Afraid of Americans and did an almost Brazilian beat kind of vibe underneath it. It's a very cool version of it. But if it were me, I would have to totally rework the song because I think I would do a lousy job trying to cover it. But I just love the idea of being able to belt out something like Blue Jean. I love that song so much. And of the songs that came out in the early 80s in the MTV era when he was really, really at the height of his popularity, Blue Jean was the only one that really said to me, this is something different. This is something new. This is something un-David Bowie. And that's what I'm always looking for from him, or always was anyway, is the next thing he was going to do that didn't sound like everything else he'd done.
I'll tell you that it's a really nice thing that, you know, I'm able to plop from something in the 60s. You went to the 80s. She pulled out from the 90s.
Right. Again, shows you the relevance all the way along.
I think it's enough to stay away from the stuff that's already become de rigueur.
Right.
So,
and we'll skip over one and come back to Tom Petty and end on that note. But before we do, she also made note of Jack Bruce and his death and went with Politician by Cream. Too tough for me to, I don't know, that song, and she does a very, that's probably the, I'm going to let me back up a second because I just started 8 sentences there and didn't finish any of them. She took that song in a very similar direction. It's probably the one that sounds the most like the original version on the entirety of this album is Politician by Cream. But that song, when it comes to the Cream catalog, I always found it kind of plodding. And it just never, I don't know, it never grabbed me, which is rare for me to say about a song that those guys did. But for me, I would go just because I love the writing in it, and I think it's so utterly weird with Anyone for Tennis.
You contrarian.
Yeah, I love that song.
Actually, you know what? I wouldn't fuck around. I love I Feel Free. Pure and simple. We used to do it, you know, and we had a great time doing it, you know, and I love doing that song. So that song is as easy for me to slip on like comfortable jeans.
Yeah.
That's the thing about it. If I was going to cover these songs, I, you know, the ones that are the most, you know, that's why David Bowie, I could just walk into a studio. I'd let Richard Barone conduct the orchestra and I would do him and everybody else proud by knocking out Love You Till Tuesday. It'd be perfect.
Yep.
It really would. you know, and I Feel Free is no different because it's that song is part of, you know, the old Punchline set.
Right. So that familiarity is already there. And that would give you the opportunity to go in and start playing around.
Definitely.
We'll end with Tom Petty, but just to round out what she did on the album, I Am the Highway by Audioslave was one that she picked out. Life in the Fast Lane by the Eagles to pay homage to Glenn Frey's death.
I was going to say, you know, if they're not in there, then something's wrong. Without a doubt, I would have to do Lion Eyes.
Yeah.
No question.
I would probably sing Harmony with you.
We could open 4 or 5 harmonies and it would be perfect.
Yes. And she also did You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore. So, there's really not a whole lot of space to move from there because, if you're going to do a Leslie Gore song, you're pretty much going to do that one. But as we get to Tom Petty, the thing that I love about this is that she didn't pick out a hit by any means. The song that she did from Petty was Luna. And again, it's gorgeous. And she does, in the kind of most important of ways, make it her own song. But I don't know if I would go that direction. If you were going to do a Petty one, which one would you pick? And it's hard to pick just one.
Oh, it's obvious. I would do The Waiting without missing a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I still do The Waiting in my acoustic set. You know, no way, no how. And if I was going to get castigated for doing a hit, I don't care. First of all, it's my favorite Petty song. But if I was going to do another one, I'd do Women in Love. Period.
Great song.
It would always put the guys in stitches when we would play it, and I would start to sing, and I would know that especially the second verse after the first chorus, you know, well, all right, do what you want, that part, because I would always deliberately, you know, exaggerate Petty.
Right.
So it would put them in hysterics, and we'd always wind up fucking up the song in the process.
Well, the first time I was ever on stage after high school with a real band was a band that we put together for a radio station when I was about 20. And one of the songs that was in our set was You Don't Know How It Feels to Be Me. And I love it when Petty gets that kind of wry and when he starts writing in character. I don't know if I would do that one again, but if I was to pick out any song, it would also be one that was very much written in character. And I think the saddest part about the song is that people don't get that he wasn't describing himself in it. People don't understand, unless you're a real hardcore Petty fan or you've got a great ear for this kind of thing, that he was writing a satire, and it was a very dark satire when he wrote Rebels, because it makes it sound like Petty's being one of these, oh, South is going to rise again, you know, go Johnny Reb bullshit assholes. And he wasn't. He was telling those people, what you're doing is crocked. Stop it. And, you know, and doing it in a way that was inoffensive to them. So that's kind of cool. And on top of that, it's just a killer fucking groove. That song moves so well.
I never really pick it apart to analyze it because I just loved it from the moment I heard it. But the thing about The Waiting is it's such a powerful lyric, you know.
Yep.
It's joyful. It's meaningful. It's got its moments of melancholia. It's got one of the greatest, you know, call and response bits in a pop song. Especially in that era, you know, the guitars are just glorious. You know, I'd want to do it just right with a 12-string Rick and just, you know, and a big fat production, you know, just exploding out of it. But, you know, but just that opening line. It's great because it rolls all of your emotions up in one neat little verse.
Right. And you know, you go back to Rebels, and the opening line of the song is, "Honey, don't walk out. I'm too drunk to follow." I mean, you want to talk about a way to grab somebody by the balls and say, you're going to listen to this song right now. That's a great way to do it.
What were some of the other ones that you skipped, just out of curiosity?
That was it. I think we went into all of them. So.
I mean, just the fact that you were going to gloss over the Eagles, for shame. For shame.
Well, again, I find myself in that camp of, okay, if I'm going to try and do an Eagles song, which one of 100 am I going to try to pick out? So.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that is kind of, it's almost the happy problem.
Right.
You know, of having too many good songs to pick out.
Yeah, and if you're going to do something, I mean, there are so many icons in there as well. And if you're going to cover something like Hotel California, you have to do what the Gypsy Kings did and take it in an entirely different direction, you know, and do it all in Spanish or whatever. And that I love that version of Hotel California, but you can't. I mean, nobody else can do that. Nobody else can pull that one off.
The thing is, though, it's a great concept, and I would see the thing is that I have oh my God, quick update. It is 10-1 Boston over the Yankees.
Nice.
Top of the fifth inning in New York.
Well, you know, I've said it before. I'll say it again. Hal Steinbrenner, you were an asshole in eighth grade, and you're still an asshole now.
Many, 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 many years I have had this concept in my mind of doing a covers album because everybody's done one. And I just would simply do one of the songs I love, and it would be called Pop Cycles.
I love it.
You know, and it would be, and it would have things like Love You Till Tuesday, you know, and I even, you know, because this is how I sometimes will think when I'm hearing some of these songs, and I know it's going to fit on this album concept of mine, you know, I can see the little movie that goes with it, because I wouldn't do videos, I would do little films, you know, it would just be brilliant, it really would. So
we'll wait for that when it come out. In the meantime, Immortal is out from Ann Wilson. Get it. It really is. It's something that you should definitely run through and hear. Oh, and by the way, during the interview, she said that Heart is going to happen again.
I would presume with the original members.
Yes.
I figured as much. Roger Fisher, et cetera, et cetera. Mike DeRosa. Cool. So for next week, I got some treats for our listeners and for you. As you can see in front of me, can you read that? It's called The Death of Rock.
Yep.
Alex Chilton and Peter Holsapple in one hand. And this one's the kicker because I would have never guessed in a million years that this was going to be reissued or issued ever. Because it very briefly came out in 1970 and was gone almost as quickly. It came out on a very tiny label called Amos Records, distributed by Bell Records. This is a band called Long Branch Penny Whistle. And if you don't know who Long Branch Penny Whistle are, they would be Glenn Frey and J.D. Souther.
Oh, nice. I've heard of those guys.
I heard the songs. I listened to them. I never thought that this would ever get issued on CD, and all of a sudden, there it is. Interestingly enough, they actually did the print on the disc itself the way that the album appeared. So hats off to Geffen for getting that right. My hope is that the Shiloh album, because ironically enough, Shiloh were also on Amos Records, weirdly enough. That was the band that Don Henley was in before the Eagles. They were label mates and didn't even know each other. But yeah, so that'll be on tap for next week because they'll both be on Music Tap.
Good deal, man. We'll see you at Music Tap. And Rob Ross, have a great week. And we'll do it all again next time.
Yes, indeed, brother. Stay well. And to our listening audience, as always, thank you.